Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Caroline Manring. Manring received her BA in English from Cornell and her MFA from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. Her work has appeared in the Colorado Review, the Seneca Review, Sixth Finch, and Verse Daily. Her first full-length collection of poems is entitled Manual for Extinction, which won the 2012 National Poetry Review Book Award. She currently teaches in the English department of Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, and is the assistant poetry editor for the Seneca Review. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish. It's a pleasure.
Now, tell us when you discovered poetry. Was this one of those things that you started out as a child being interested in?
Yes. I think I wouldn't have guessed that poetry was where I was headed. I always felt it was music. But this is just another form of music, I think.
Yeah, it is.
But it was definitely early. My mother used to pay us a dollar for every poem we could memorize.
Really?
Yeah, she understood the currency of rhythm and of memorization, just carrying something with you and always having it, not having to look it up. And I think she also liked to hear our small voices reciting funny poems. So there was a value placed on that. In our moment.
Well, I think it would be valuable to get more kids to read out loud, too.
Absolutely.
That's certainly an art that we seem to be losing. Now, did you always consider that once you knew that writing was going to be one of your focuses, that you would also teach?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think when people used to ask me, let's say, in maybe elementary school, third grade, so what are you going to do? I'd say, well, an artist or a teacher. And so, you know, often
you ended up doing
prophetic
both.
That way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was prescient.
A lot of people do want to go into teaching, which surprises me in some ways, because it seems like such a complicated profession. Now, let's talk about Manual for Extinction. It's a fascinating book. It's, you know, it's musical, it's funny, it's sometimes gritty. Tell us about it. Was it a whole piece that you thought about, or did you just start writing and then you realized, oh, this is a book?
First, let me just say I'm so glad you said funny as your second adjective choice for it. That makes me so happy. It can look pretty grim, you know, right from the outset with the title to think, oh boy, what's this girl up to? Is she just is it going to be gloom and doom? And I'm so glad that you found it funny because I laugh when I read a lot. But as for how it came about, I can tell you exactly the moment it began. I was on, we used to have a old junker of a sailboat that we picked up, you know, how as one does from family, friends, and whatnot. And we were out on a beautiful day, and since I'm not really a sailor, I'm always learning, but my husband is, he was at the helm, and I was in the front of the boat just getting sprayed, and I had a little, just a journal with me. I always have something to jot things down in. And a phrase came into my head, and I forget exactly what the phrase was, but it just had the name Geraldine in it or something. It had some funny names in it, and I didn't know, who are these people? I don't know. And that's often how things start for me, is with a sound. And it was a phrase that had these names in it. And so I explored, and I just started writing, and almost instantly developed this rule that I wouldn't try to make any sense. That sense could come later. But first, I needed to get down the energy that was poking these little names and things into my head. And then that became writing for 15 minutes to an hour each day. And then I wouldn't look at it until later. And then I would boil it down. It was just essentially nonsensical prose. And then I would basically cross out 70% of it and work with the remaining 30, and then further distill that and rearrange it and lineate. And that's how this particular collection came about.
That's fascinating. So you were in some ways listening to the music.
Yes.
You can feel the music of the poetry for
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. I can feel the music far more clearly than the sense of it often, which is why it's kind of a giddy and entertaining and also dreadful thing to try and talk about the poems with people. And it's part of why I feel excited about this opportunity to talk with you about it, because I learn every time I try to articulate in conversation what's happening on the page.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of poets, you know, you end up realizing what you were writing about sometimes when you start talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to have you read a piece from Manual for Extinction. This one is called How to Believe You Are a Founding Father.
Okay. How to Believe You Are a Founding Father. No one has to wait in line for long. You may be shocked by the way real organs feel in your hands. You will find your life is neither yours nor empty. Putting us all in one place accents the lack of planning. When you're not measuring or masoning, you begin to apprehend meaning. Blow-up lawn ornaments, deer that fall when they cross, alpacas gathering by the fence.
I love these. There is so much music to them. Do you come up with a title after you've written some of the words and polished them, or do the titles come and then you continue on?
I did write them after the words, the body of the poem came about, and it's interesting because they're not as cheeky as they sound. This title is ridiculous. How to Believe You Are a Founding... Why would you want to believe you are a founding father? You know, it takes on the machinery of instructing someone. But that's not just ironic, really. It's actually my best and most fluid, sometimes capricious, but fluid and honest attempt at describing what it was I was trying to teach myself when I wrote the words, in the body of the poem. What was it I was searching for? And it's an approximation thereof, you know. So I would read through what I said, and then I would ask myself, what is it you're trying to learn? And the feeling here was not exactly how to believe I'm a founding father, but the feeling of antiquity, the feeling of authority.
Yeah, and I was thinking the feeling of something new.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the poems in this collection have that beginning two words, how to.
Yes.
Was that coming from the same place as you trying to talk to yourself about what you were trying to learn?
Yes, and I'm actually extremely wary of projects, you know, in air quotes, projects. I feel that it can limit, I always felt that it could limit what the creative person is working on by saying, oh, I have to make it fit in a certain way. But this particular project of having these titles of how that begin with how to, this sort of instruction manual feel, just felt really, again, honest and true to what I was doing. So it became a little sort of driving mechanism.
Uh-huh. And you know what? The poems in this book and some of the stuff that you're conveying to us is the opposite of extinction.
Thank you.
I mean, to me, that's the irony of the title as well.
Yeah.
Because at first I thought, oh, my God, this is something, that, you know, this is going to be some depressing thing from an environmentalist.
Yeah. Some pamphlet on how to recycle, right?
Yeah. But this is the opposite of extinction.
I'm so glad you say that. I have a poet friend, Melanie Noel, whose book I've been reading lately and I'm going to be teaching my students this fall, she has a book called The Monarchs that's really lovely, and I was talking with her via email, and she generously called the book, once I sent it to her, something that felt a little bit like a complex joke with the punchline first. So I think it's a little bit along the lines of
what
you're
feeling.
Yeah, I can see.
But it makes you want to open it, thinking, what is she going to be saying about something that doesn't exist anymore? Well, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk to you about the fact that you have a serious interest in both birding and music.
Yeah.
So tell us how that informs your poetry and adds to the whole creative collective of what you do.
Wow. Great question, and a huge one. I think it goes very deep. Music I've been trained in since I was really small. My family of origin, my mother's side of the family, the Robinsons were my grandparents, David and Louise Robinson, were founders of the Skinny Atlas Music Festival.
Oh, wow.
In Skinny Atlas, which is now, you know, world class,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Started in Library Hall. So I grew up hearing chamber music rehearsals. I would walk into my grandparents' house and was just as likely to hear Brahms' sextet being rehearsed on the Oriel rug in the living room as I was to hear, you know, cousins running around screaming. So that, and I didn't realize that wasn't normal, really.
Yeah.
Or that wasn't average until much more recently. So the music has just always been there. I think it informs my poems almost seamlessly. I feel things rhythmically. I feel an imperative for certain vowels and consonants that will drive the meaning. So rather than me trying to transcribe a thought I've already had and agreed to, I'm trying to lay the gesture down, the musical gesture, and then fill in an approximate sense that will create, that will co-create the experience of the musicality. There.
Wow, that's really... And you play the fiddle, right?
Yeah,
I'm trained on viola
classically since I was little, but I picked up the fiddle in the last decade simply because my father's great-great-grandfather, who was a postman, made instruments, stringed instruments, on the side for fun. And we had an heirloom one sitting around. It was out of shape, so we had it cleaned up, and I started playing. And now I play out in bars with a band, Dean's
List. That's so interesting to me. So why is it, do you think, Caroline, that you didn't decide to try to write songs, or have you?
I do that, too.
You do that as well?
Not recently. I seem to only do one thing at a time, but I enjoy things like painting and crafts, like Ukrainian eggs, and I'll do all kinds of stuff, but it seems to be one thing at a time. Uh-huh. And I had a big sort of songwriting phase from 16 to probably 20-something, and then it was poetry, and now I'm working on a novel. I just never know what's going to come next.
But the creativity just keeps shooting out of you. It's really quite...
Or shooting into me.
It's shooting into you, and then you're bringing it out for all of us to see. Now, I want to have you read another poem from Manual for Extinction. Okay. This is called How to Be Extinct.
Yes, okay. How to Be Extinct. All the banging became coherent, like subtitles siphoning ocean into a bowl. What can we subtract to expose substrate like a billion-dollar tomb? Sometimes you. Then I see the footprints in the dregs are avian or a moth's. Often we remove with partial success the competing heartbeat. Have you ever spread someone's ashes with your hands? I take mules into the stable of my heart and wonder why there are so precious few escapes.
I love that last line. Now, you have said that your poetry tends to explore the natural world and how we fit into it.
Mm.
So talk to us a little bit more about that, because in some ways we don't fit into it anymore, and we're getting further and further away from it. Don't you sense that?
Yes, absolutely. I also think that we're inseparable
from
it, and I think it can be a mistake to think, well, there's man and then there's nature.
Yeah.
Because the thing that isn't part of your bloodstream, that isn't part of your DNA, that isn't part of your context, your relevance, is easy to disregard, to disable, to maim, to disrespect, to commit atrocity against. But if it is you, if you are inseparable, you know, some people say the earth is going to be fine. It's people who are in trouble. Earth will be here when we're gone, you know? Uh-huh. That's one way of looking at it. Yeah, but I just think we're getting further away from it, but we also can't. So we're doing this strange paradoxical thing that is creating a vacuum, really. And I think what's moving into that is a lot of the arts and a lot of socially conscious, wonderful things going on in urban and city planning and movement towards sustainable energies and agricultures. I think they're moving in, but there's a deep lack. There's a grief there. There's a loss. There's a deep loss when you move away from things like your food sources or understanding what time of day it is even, or season, or... I'm not saying everybody has to live on a small farm. Of course, that's just not possible. And urban life can be immensely rewarding and ecologically sound. So it's not really a suburban versus urban thing. But I think that we need to be in touch with the things that sustain us.
Yeah, I understand that, too. If you're just joining us, my guest is Caroline Manring. We're talking about her new full-length collection of poetry called Manual for Extinction. You know, I've had a lot of guests on who talk about the fact that they're so worried about kids today, because kids are not even being allowed to have recess. They're not allowed to go out and enjoy the natural world. So it seems to me you're right about art filling in the vacuum, and this book in particular is a part of that. Now, I do want to have you read another poem from Manual for Extinction. This is called How to Play the Most Beautiful Quartet in the World.
Okay. Ridiculous titles, right?
No, I love them. I love them.
I'm glad they make you smile. How to Play the Most Beautiful Quartet in the World. To step on a fox tooth or a fish bone on the railroad tracks and not know what it is opens one vein in an evening that wasn't there before. One more place for blood to go. My sister is not the queen, but she is one such place. In every student, there's a teacher causing problems. Like the statue you sat on and didn't have the heart to let anyone know. You stay seated, present at the bridal shower. Like the shuttle launch, the Mars fanatic somehow forgot to calendar. But it happens, and brightly, too. Rescued or not, with binoculars, one can learn a bird's field marks all right, though one may never be great at reading the sky.
I love that last line. That's so beautiful. That's what you put in your love for birding along with your love of music, and then that one poem. It's beautiful. I love last lines that give me some place to soar to. You know.
Well, that's what poems trade in, right? Is beginnings and endings.
Exactly. I think so too.
Stuff, right?
And you know, a lot of people don't concentrate, in my opinion, enough on the endings.
Yeah.
You're left like with a novel that doesn't end right. And you think, whoa, this didn't take me anywhere.
I always think it should make the energy spin forward. It should cause more questions.
It
should cause you to read it again. It should cause you to read something else.
Yeah. Or to catch something in that little breeze that just went by as you were reading it. Now, you teach a course called Mad About You, Poetry and Mental Illness, and I find that incredibly fascinating. Tell us more about that.
Oh, great. Well, that came about because I noticed the drive of students and all thinkers, really, all inquirers, to pair up biography with poetry. You know, we always want to know, oh, was this person suffering? Was this person crazy? We've come, and with good reason, gotten used to the idea that poets are nuts. and they are, but I don't think it's the poetry that causes it. In fact, I think the poetry can be a balm for that. And I don't think it's correct that people work best when they are anguished.
I agree.
I don't think that at all. But I think it's worth looking at our drive to think about biography and how do the poems exist in and of themselves? Because I think often people are at their best on the page when that's their sort of vocation. And it can be somewhat unwise to just say, oh, well, they were a hurting soul, look at this poem, or they were in love with so-and-so, look at this poem. I think poems deserve a little bit more complexity and respect than to say it came straight from biography. I think there's a little bit more of an alchemical thing going on. So that's where the idea came from. But then you also do want to respect the turmoil, the difficulty, the strangeness in people's lives. And I've actually tried to help students learn to celebrate differences that way, to look at the struggles of different poets, their dispositions, to look at melancholy, to look at this whole spectrum of difference and difficulty of the mind and the psyche, and to start saying, okay, this made a lot of learning possible for a lot of people. This made a lot of experience possible for a lot of people. So not just to look at mental illness as, you know, an anchor around your neck, throw you into the ocean, but to think of it as a thing that forced you to learn how to swim. In a lot of ways.
Yeah, so, and I've often thought that art and poetry especially has given voice to the outsider, which to me was an aspect of what you're talking about.
It really cultivates empathy, which I think is at the ground zero of where we need to be for so many reasons right now.
And a lot of therapists use poetry and art for people to be able to articulate how they're feeling when they can't just in a narrative form. That's really interesting. Now, you say you try to make words and the world a more alien place to my students. That's another thing that you have said. Tell us about that, because, I mean, your poetry sort of proves that. Think differently in some ways. Talk to us about that, though.
Yeah, it's definitely weirdo poetry. I think the most fruitful place to be is estranged to some degree, because that's when you become alive again to your surroundings, to possibility, to what you're seeing and feeling and hearing. And that's probably where the birding comes in. And that was the second part of your question way back that I never answered. But that's part of why I celebrate it, is the acute awareness and liveliness, that the electricity that it requires from just observing. You really need to pay attention and soak things up and to be still and to be quiet and to be sort of simultaneously searching but also sitting back and allowing things to happen and then using the acute skills of your brain at the drop of a hat. It all sort of...
Yeah, but to me, though, that thing about being a stranger and being estranged can also shut people down, right?
Definitely. So it's a danger.
It is.
But, I mean, I'm already off that cliff by writing poetry to begin with. So one of my peers in grad school, and I'm probably quoting him wrong, but his name is Mark Leidner. He was a year ahead of me, and he always said something about an effort-to-awesomeness ratio, where it's okay to put in a 10 out of 10 of effort if you get a 10 out of 10 of awesomeness out of the experience, right? So I think it's okay to ask for some effort if you're going to really trust yourself to do your very best at returning the favor in the very careful gestures and choices of language and music.
Yeah. And I've often thought that if you want to be a really good writer, you need to travel.
Yes.
And be that stranger in
yes.
a strange land.
Because yep.
you discover so much about yourself when you do that.
You learn as much about your home as about the place you're in when you travel, definitely.
Yeah. And when I used to travel and get lonely, I'd used to go get novels that I was familiar with just so I wouldn't totally lose my balance in a strange land. So that's where art comes in to save us as well as help us explore. Now, Manual for Extinction, I want to have one more poem I think we have time for, How to Be an Addict.
Okay. How to be an addict. I have always been ahead of myself. The nut white pill, the wild pony. I even gave me a harp. I've located the place where one need not locate anything. In the idea, you are an experience. One sleeps when all else is a fisted dozen. Why would I stay when whole houses can be dragged across the ice on sledges and reassembled? I sleep where we know what the land tells me I began as.
I love that last line.
Thank you.
Know what? In some ways it makes no sense, and in some ways I totally identify with it. I sleep where we know what the land tells me I began as. I love that. It really caught me. Now, tell us a little bit more about your teaching. I want to hear more about how you inspire and how you direct kids and young adults to trust themselves. See, that's the thing that a lot of young writers, that they censor themselves.
Mm. Well, I try to give them a break from their egos. It's a tyranny we all live under.
What do you do? What does that mean?
I use a lot of constraints. I think you have to fulfill this strange constraint, like don't use the letter T, or it has to be exactly 56 words. And those things are not valuable in and of themselves. It's not because it's 56 words that it's a good poem, right? The strength is that your sort of chatty brain, the one that judges you, was busy thinking about how to jump that hurdle, so it didn't get in your way when the stuff that needed to happen was trying to happen. So I do a lot of constraints, I do a lot of estrangement, and I think mostly try to slow them down. We do breathing exercises, some of that stuff that sounds kind of touchy-feely and they giggle at first, but then by the end of the semester they're usually saying, oh, can we do that exercise? I really need it, you know? So I try to slow them down, I think, and I tell them this, it's one of the best gifts I can give them, is permission and strategies for slowing down. Because nobody else is working on teaching them that, unless they're taking a meditation course or really working on being outdoors and breathing. And most people aren't really trained to do that.
Yeah, and I do worry about kids just constantly concentrated on electronic media instead of thinking on their own without these extra little gadgets to keep them distracted. That's really interesting to me. Where do you find inspiration besides nature? Are you finding inspiration just in everyday life?
I never know where it'll come from. I'm advising students right now on their schedules, freshmen, you know, and it's funny, I tell them, I couldn't have told you I was going to be working on a novel that involves scientists in a decade and a half, you know. So I'm trying to encourage them, you know, go ahead and take that biology course, even if you think you don't like biology. You can't know where it's going to come from. Most recently, I think I kind of marinate. I wait until it occurs to me what is feeding me and what needs to happen. It could be anything from a phrase or a gesture to a collection of experiences. I think a lot of it has to do with what I'm reading and what films I'm watching and what people I'm around. Mm-hmm. And there's always that undercurrent or that steady pulse of the landscape and what I'm seeing that's always there. So that's a given, and the rest is circumstantial, but it largely has to do with the art that I'm exposed to.
Yeah. And I know you were born and raised in this region. Have you traveled much, and has that inspired you as well?
I'm not a great world traveler, but I have traveled. I spent some time in England, Costa Rica, and, you know, around the U.S. My husband's a pilot, so I sometimes get to join him in different places in the U.S., and that's been lovely. I think I don't need to travel more than I do because it is such a stimulating thing for me. It's pretty big. It definitely electrifies me when I go. I love it, but it's exhausting, and then I have to sort of chew on it for a while.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely informs what I do, though.
I can see a collection of cloud poems coming from the pilot connection. To tell us what you think about as an individual poet and what you teach your students about performing and reading live, how important is that? It almost seems like a language that we're on the verge of losing, that live in-person kind of...
The reading aloud?
Yeah, yeah. And knowing how to do it.
Ah, okay. Well, here's an exercise that we do. Here's probably a good example. I split up the class, and Ammons' poems work really well for this. R.G. Ammons, who was a Cornell guy and wonderful poet. I love his work. So I teach him in environmental literature, and there's usually 20 to 25 students in that class, and I'll say, okay, everybody gets one line in this long poem. And sometimes those lines are one word. Sometimes they're six words, and they're often very severely enjambed, so the line will break before the thought is done.
Ah.
And it can feel very awkward to pass off your line if you say, and there was a, and the next person's supposed to say bluebird. You know, it's difficult, right? So you have to work together. You have to start breathing. You have to start anticipating. And so inevitably, the first time through is a total train wreck, and it's hilarious. And, you know, I enjoy making a point of we all laugh about it, and then I say, okay, let's say that was a C-. Let's try again. And usually by the fourth, fifth, sixth time through, they're pretty serious. They realize that I'm going to keep chewing on this bone until they do a convincing rendition of this.
Yeah.
And so they have to sort of work as an organism. And it also teaches lineation. So why break something into lines? So they can hear each voice reading from a single poem, but being its own world unto itself, even if it's incomplete.
God, that sounds really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because I've had a lot of people ask me about that. Why do poets end a line here and then the word continues? What is one supposed to make of that verbally?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're actually training kids how to read a poem, essentially.
Yeah, another great answer to that question is write it out in prose. Write out a short poem in prose and hand it to someone as a paragraph and say, what would you do? And then in the making of the choices, they say, oh, that's why they're doing this.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Now, we are almost out of time. You're working on a new novel, and is it about fracking? Is that what I heard? Or science? Or?
About is a tricky word. It's not about fracking, but it definitely, that's part of it, and that's part of the inciting sort of momentum of it. It's situated around that topic, I would say. And
a major topic here in our region, of course.
Yes, a major topic, and I think one of urgent importance. So that's the landscape, literally and figuratively, in which these characters are dwelling and trying to find meaning.
And are you going to be doing any readings in the coming months, anywhere in the region that you can tell people about?
Not in town, but if you're in Iowa City on... the 23rd of September, I'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore, and I guess check the website for upcoming other readings. We'll post as needed.
Yeah, I hope to hear you do a reading here sometime in the region. Contact information?
CarolineManring.com, and my email's on there, my Twitter's on there, and feel free to contact me.
Great, great. Well, Caroline Manring, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure to discover your work and to share it with my listeners. Again, the book's called Manual for Extinction. Go out and get it. Thank you.
My pleasure, Tish. Thanks.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.